From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For the first time in three decades, new nuclear power plants are under construction in the U.S., in Georgia and South Carolina. And because it's been so long, these plants represent more than just an additional power source for their local areas. As our guest today writes, their success or failure could determine the future of nuclear energy in America. We're talking this hour with New York Times reporter Matthew Wald, who's covered energy for 30 years. In fact, he started just around the time when the infamous Three Mile Island accident gave many Americans solid fears about atomic power. But over the past decade or so, Wald writes, the nuclear industry had expected a kind of renaissance as it received more praise as a low-carbon alternative to dirty fossil fuels. The government gave out tax credits, construction permits became easier to get, plans were drawn up in several areas, and ground was broken down south. Then 2 years ago, the nuclear meltdown at the Fukushima plant in Japan eliminated talk of a renaissance. And now Wald writes, there's another challenge to atomic energy. In addition to longstanding concerns about safety, the economics of nuclear, he says, are not what they once were, given the newfound abundance and low cost of natural gas as an alternative. Today in The Exchange, which way for atomic energy? And let's hear from you. Why do you think Americans have not embraced nuclear power as some countries in Europe and Asia have? With nuclear already supplying 20% of our nation's electricity, can we afford to eliminate it as a source? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Matt Wald joins us from the D.C. area. And Matt, great to have you. Thanks a lot for your time this morning.
Hello, Laura. Good to be here.
Well, let's just start off, Matt, if we could, by stepping back a bit. Trace for us, please, the ups and downs, this sort of ride that nuclear power has had in this country in terms of how the public feels about it.
Well, public feeling is important. It started out in the Eisenhower era as a way to make something good out of nuclear science, which had given us Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It advanced to being too cheap to meter, being the fuel of the future. It certainly was cleaner than coal. It looked good after the Arab oil embargo in 1974, when the price of oil rose sharply, when a lot of our electricity came from oil. And then it started to look worse as it competed with coal, as we replaced the oil with cheaper coal. Three Mile Island certainly didn't help, but it turns out we scaled up this industry awfully fast. We broke ground on plants like Seabrook that were not completely designed. Work bogged down, prices went up. They were being built in a period of very high inflation, and that pushed their costs up. High interest costs pushed their costs up because they're capital-intensive investments. So we built a bunch of them, and then we stopped. And that lasted until just a few years ago when we began again with a new philosophy, which is we're only going to build plants that have already been almost completely designed. We're going to build them in a standardized way. We're going to stamp them out, and we're going to make them economically viable. And that sort of would have worked, except that they still exist in a dynamic energy marketplace. And the big news in the energy marketplace is natural gas is cheap. If natural gas is cheap, it pushes down the price of electricity. If the price of your product declines and you're building an expensive machine to produce that product, then you've got a problem.
Well, and we'll definitely spend a lot of time this hour, Matt, talking about what you and others have written about, this sort of new economic challenge to nuclear energy, in addition to the safety concerns that people have long had. But just one more question about this public opinion piece. And you traced it from that heyday in the 50s and 60s to building rapidly in the 70s, and then concerns started and costs went up. Why do you think, Matt, feelings about nuclear energy is different in other countries like France or Sweden or South Korea or Belgium, all of which have a considerable amount of their electricity coming from nuclear? Why do they feel differently than we do?
Because there are two reasons. The political dynamics are different. Their system of government is somewhat different. But the other reason is nuclear compared to what? If it's compared to imported Soviet natural gas and now Russian natural gas, and it's expensive, that's a different issue than if it's compared to domestic coal or imported from Canada natural gas or hydroelectric power, or now domestic natural gas.
So we've got sort of closer by, less controversial sources of power.
More to the point, cheaper.
Yeah. So they don't have as many good options in Europe, is what you're saying.
Correct.
Interesting.
If you're in the nuclear business, what you really want to do is build a reactor someplace where it's going to displace oil, because oil is expensive. It'd be nice to displace coal. You don't want to build it in a place where it's going to displace cheap natural gas. That isn't possible.
I want to invite our listeners to join us, Matt, and then a lot more questions. And I know our audience will have a lot of questions, too. The number on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're sitting down with Matthew Wald, longtime reporter for The New York Times. He's covered energy issues for about 3 decades. He's written a lot about nuclear energy, especially about some of the changing economics around nuclear power lately. The number for you to join us again with your questions and comments is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Keep those emails short. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. So, Matt, let's talk about the fact that this new construction is going on for the first time in 30 years, which seems amazing. Your article earlier this summer described these two projects being built down south. You said, you know, this is more than just more power for Georgia and South Carolina. This represents the future of nuclear power. Everybody's watching this, people told you. Why are these so important?
Well, they are designed, we've gotten smarter about design in the last 30 years, and these are designed to have many fewer pumps and valves, many fewer things that can go wrong, to rely on forces that will always be there, like gravity and natural circulation of heat, and basically to have a much, much lower chance, whatever you believe the chance is, of catastrophic accident. They're also designed to be easier to operate. Get all those things put together, and the remaining question is, what does it cost to build them? So they're also intended to have a more rational construction method. More of them will be built in factories, modules will be shipped, they'll be standardized, construction will be smooth. Some of those things have happened, some of those have not quite happened as intended. But if these two projects come in, when these two projects come in at some price, everybody will know exactly what it costs to build. This is a business where a lot of people want to be second. Nobody really wants to be first. The other thing that's happening is by the time these projects are done, we may have a somewhat clearer idea of the future price of natural gas. The price of natural gas is highly variable. It goes up and down. It will go up again. Nobody knows quite how soon or how much. And if you had a better idea what the competition was going to do, then you'd have a clearer idea whether you, too, wanted to build a reactor.
So you have to look at what the market is going to do, and frankly, nobody knows.
Correct.
So talking about these plants, again,
If I knew, I wouldn't be on the phone with you. I'd be down on the floor of the New York Mercantile Exchange making enough money to retire.
Exactly.
Right.
So you call these two projects, you know, maybe the industry's last best hope, you know, smarter about design. For example, fewer pumps and valves so you don't have... hopefully you don't have leaks and so forth, which have been a problem with the older plants. But give us a little bit more, Matt, on some of these promises have not worked out as planned. There have been delays and other issues.
Well, a company set itself up to build modules. It's kind of like Lego, and they would build sub-modules that would be assembled into modules. It would be done in a factory where quality control is easier. It would be done serially. You'd build a bunch of them, not one at a time. And not one and then no more, and that would give you some expertise. It's always easier to do it the second time or the third time or the tenth time. What happened was that company turned out to have startup problems. It had trouble delivering on schedule. It delivered with missing paperwork or bad paperwork. It delivered with some parts that weren't quite right. It wasn't quite up to nuclear standards. So there have been delays. In nuclear construction, delays can be a severe problem because it's like you're building a house, and the mortgage payments start before the house is occupied. The mortgage payments start as soon as the builder gets to work, and the longer it takes the builder to get the job done, the more you've paid out in interest during construction, so the price tag goes up.
Go ahead, yeah.
That was really miserable, for instance, when they were building Seabrook, which was when Jimmy Carter was trying to stop inflation now, and Gerald Ford, and interest rates hit 17%. It's not so bad now because interest rates are low, but it really is not a great sign if you can't build on schedule.
So why is this modular idea important? I like your description of it, Matt, as Legos.
Yeah, if you have to perform precise welding out in the field, you have to train people, teach them to do a job once, and that's the only time they do it. It's not very effective. If you have workers in a factory and they can turn these things out like they're a Ford Taurus or something, they can do the same thing over and over for several different plants and do it in more or less pristine factory conditions, you can improve quality and you can cut costs. This requires that you have several plants to do and that you be capable of setting up a manufacturing system that runs smoothly. We've sort of got several plants to do. There are four under construction. People had hoped for more, but we don't really have smooth production in the factory of components yet.
How much do you think the Obama administration played a role in these two facilities finally getting off the ground down south? How much of a push was there from President Obama and Congress?
As it turns out, hardly any. Initially, the theory was nobody would build without loan guarantees. Federal loan guarantees, but these plants at this point are going forward with commercial financing. They may end up with loan guarantees, but it's evident that the loan guarantees are not absolutely essential. There were some changes back in the 90s to the way that we license plants that may turn out to be more important. One of them was you used to get a permit to build a plant, and then it was done, you'd go back and get a permit to operate it. The new system is, you get a design that's already approved. You get a site that's approved. You say, okay, I'm going to build that approved design on this approved site, and they give you a license to run it. And at the end, when you're done with construction, there's only one issue, which is, did you build it the way you said you were going to? This has the potential to eliminate delays at the back end, give greater confidence to the builders, and make it a more rational construction system. That's not Obama. That's a little older. The thing that Obama might have liked to do, but that didn't happen, was to put a price on carbon.
Okay, a carbon tax, and we'll definitely talk about that after a short break. Some in the nuclear industry would love to see a carbon tax. We will talk a lot more. We'll be back in just a minute.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. What's going on this week at NHPR? Well, there's an easy way for you to find out. When you sign up for our e-newsletter this week at NHPR, you'll find out what the exchange, word of mouth, and our newsroom are planning for the week and get a behind-the-scenes look at the station. Click on the Connect menu to sign up for our e-newsletter at nhpr.org. Partly sunny today, chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. Some thunderstorms may produce gusty winds, small hail, heavy rainfall, and frequent lightning, especially north of the Lakes region, highs mid-80s to around 90. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Dr. Rod Burdett and Riverview Dental of Concord, offering same-day tooth replacement with mini dental implants for stable chewing and enhanced denture retention. Details at 228-1066. And Vineyard Brands Importers of Goats to Rome, wines from the Pearl Valley of South Africa, available at New Hampshire State Liquor Stores, goatstorome.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about nuclear energy in this country, its prospects and problems. We invite you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Which way do you see this country going in terms of atomic energy? Why do you think, in general, Americans have not embraced nuclear power as some in Europe and Asia have? And nuclear power does already supply 20% of our nation's electricity, so could we afford to eliminate it as a power source? Let's hear what you think. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our guest for the hour is Matthew Wald, longtime reporter for the New York Times. He's been covering energy issue for about 30 years. He writes extensively about nuclear energy. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. And Matt, lots of response from our listeners on Facebook, email, and phones. Let's take a call first, if we could. Rick's joining us from Wilton. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
With nuclear providing 20% of our nation's energy today, the supply of uranium worldwide seems to me is going to be running out in 50 to 70 years, from what I've heard. So if we double or triple our nuclear power generation, won't we be having a fuel supply problem unless we change technologies?
Rick, this is a great question. What do you think? Are we going to run out of uranium if we go too far down this route, Matt?
Well, the new theory is no. The new theory is price might rise a little, but at a given price, more will be available. MIT did a study about 4 years ago, and it said that if worldwide the number of reactors increased tenfold, we'd still have enough for at least a century, and it doesn't look like the number of reactors is going to increase tenfold. If you really thought you were running short, you'd go back to the used fuel, spent fuel, and when you run a reactor of the kind we run in this country, some of the uranium gets converted into plutonium. You could recover the plutonium and run reactors on that. The French do a little bit of that.
Recycling, it's called.
Recycling. The reason we don't do it is it's not worth it. You can start with fresh uranium cheaper than you can recycle and scavenge the plutonium.
But if we had to, we could.
If we had to, we could, but it doesn't look like we're going to have to.
Well, and Rick, thanks for the question. And it leads into a question from Facebook from Donna. Thank you, Donna. Donna says, the big problem is what is done with the spent fuel rods. What do Europe and Asia do with theirs? That kind of picks up on what Rick was saying.
Right. Well, thus far, they do mostly what we do, which is they store them in pools of water, which are earthquake-proof and high quality, although nobody likes the idea of keeping them there forever. Or they store them in dry casks, which are even more secure, but also nobody likes the idea of keeping them there forever. The Sweden and Finland have made serious progress toward burying waste, but they haven't actually begun burying any yet. Eventually, everybody's going to end up burying the stuff, I believe. And even if you do recycle reprocessing, there'll still be materials you want to bury at the end of that.
You know, you said earthquake-proof, and those words are kind of a lightning rod, aren't they, after Fukushima,
yes.
Matt? I mean,
yes,
do we
yes.
really know something's earthquake-proof?
Well, you know, at the time of Fukushima, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission became convinced that one of the spent fuel pools at Fukushima had drained, it cracked and drained, but it turned out they were wrong. The spent fuel pool is in fine shape. It's got debris in it, but it's still intact. There's a national effort right now because the United States Geological Survey has changed its estimate of earthquake probability and earthquake severity in the eastern and central U.S. There's a national effort going on to demonstrate that all the plants still meet their likely earthquake. I was down at one of them, North Anna in Virginia, that was closed for, I guess, about 2 months after the earthquake we had in the eastern U.S. 2 years ago. And they went over it very carefully, and it took them a long time, but they concluded that they didn't have any damage and that the reactor and its structures were actually considerably stronger than they were required to be, but they weren't clear on precisely how much stronger. They're going to have to work out in the next few years for all these reactors just how strong they are.
Again, the number here on the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with Matthew Wald. Again, he's the energy reporter for the New York Times. We're looking at the prospects and problems with nuclear power here in this country. 1-800-892-6477 is the way for you to join us. Or send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, as Donna did. And let's go back to the phones, Matt, and Doug's waiting in Barrington. Hi, Doug. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. Just hearing the conversation so far, it seems to me you've understated the real reversal of fortune that we've seen with nuclear power. More plants are closing down than new ones being built at this point, and that's seems like it's likely to continue in coming years. These plants aren't even lasting the 40-year lifetimes they were built to stand. I'm also concerned about looking at the future and comparing nuclear. You set it up talking about natural gas, new studies are showing that natural gas isn't really much better than burning coal in terms of carbon emissions, and nuclear power certainly isn't carbon-free despite all the hype about it. If you look at the total life cycle of nuclear power. I just wanted to also mention, I don't know if the your journalist is familiar with the state of Maine's plan to build 5,000 megawatts of offshore wind power in the next 20 years. It really seems it'll revolutionize the power generation here in New England. So I wanted to ask whether he thinks, 20 years from now, whether which will provide a more significant portion of our energy power generation, nuclear power, or offshore wind and other renewable technologies.
Yeah, and Doug, so glad you called. And I did have a question. My next question was going to be about these aging plants. So you're absolutely right. A lot of the safety issues, Matt, have come up with aging plants, Vermont Yankee, and so forth. You wrote earlier this summer, when does a nuclear plant become too old? How is that assessment made, Matt, and who makes it?
Basic assessment is made by the owners, and the question's a little simpler than that. It's, can we still make money with this thing?
Even if it's leaking or causing problems?
Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will close down, not force retirement, but just order the shutdown of a plant that is a safety problem. And they've done that from time to time, although not very often. San Onofre in California, which I think is what Doug was referring to, we've had a bunch of closures. Some of them were actually quite old. Some of them were not. San Onofre, they botched a repair job. I don't think it was unsafe, it's like putting on a new tire and discovering the tire is bad and pulling over to the side of the road, and they decided it wasn't worth fixing. They had a variety of economic and political problems there. Some plants have run more than 40 years. Some have run less. The thing about the plants out there now is they're all old. They're not designed to work forever, and new competition comes along. I'd like to address Doug's point about whether or not these plants are carbon-free.
Yes, I got an email about that this morning, too. I just want to recognize Christy in Hampton, who lives within 2 miles of Seabrook, and she really takes issue with the idea that nuclear plants are carbon-free. She says they do have emissions, especially radiation. So go ahead.
Well, radiation and carbon are two different things, but they're made of concrete and steel. Manufacture of concrete releases carbon dioxide. Making steel releases carbon dioxide. Anything you do has a carbon input. Nuclear is better than solar on carbon dioxide. If you can run the reactor for some reasonable number of years, it's got a better carbon balance than solar does. It probably has a better carbon balance than wind does. But you don't do these things on carbon balance. You do these things on money. We don't price carbon in this country, and there's no evidence we're going to price carbon anytime in the near future.
Wait, nuclear has a better overall carbon footprint, if we could call it that, carbon balance?
Than solar.
If
you and I go out, yes, solar plants, it turns out, have a lot of materials in them per kilowatt hour of electricity produced, and some of those materials are very complicated to produce, and they release greenhouse gases in their production. The same, by the way, is true of hydro. If you're going to build a dam, you're going to release carbon dioxide in its manufacture.
So Doug, our caller, asked about wind. And again, my emailer, Christy in Hampton, also asked about wind. Christy says there's solid information that offshore wind could easily provide New England with an abundance of power, enough to replace 4 nuclear plants. Christy says, think of the long-term jobs in a range of skills that this creates. So what about wind, not only in terms of its carbon footprint, but also its potential to replace nuclear as a source of energy? And Christy, thanks a lot for joining us with those comments.
Well, it's certainly true that you can get more energy from a wind turbine offshore than onshore, and you can get it during hours.
Matt, did we lose you there? Matt, did we lose you? All right. We seem to have lost our guest, Matthew Wald, again, reporter for the New York Times, covering energy issues for a long time, 30 years, and writing extensively these days about nuclear power, some of the problems that have come up, some of the prospects that the industry sees for itself here in the United States. And Matt will be back with us in just a minute. In the meantime, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And while we're waiting for Matt to get back up with us, and Matt, are you there now?
Yes, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened there.
That's okay. We'll blame the DC.
The NSA, Verizon, who knows?
go ahead, please.
I'm not sure where we left off, but if you build offshore...
We're talking about wind power, yeah.
Right. It becomes wildly expensive in Massachusetts, they're discovering that it's more, it's extremely pricey, and they're not doing a lot of it. You do make the transmission problems somewhat simpler, but offshore wind may or may not be the best, from an economic standpoint, the best renewable. In addition, with any renewable, with wind or with sun, you have the capacity to save fuel. It'll produce some kilowatt hours, and therefore you won't have to burn as much coal, as much gas, etc. But you may end up building a lot of capacity that you can still rely on. You may end up building a lot of standby gas generation for times when you don't have wind and sun and you do have heavy demand.
Because they're intermittent.
Because they're intermittent and because their production profile doesn't quite match the consumption profile.
So do you think that our emailer is right, that wind power here in New England could replace as much energy as four nuclear power plants? Is there that much potential?
Absolutely. The question is, could we afford it?
So, but we often hear, Matt, that nuclear is very expensive, too. I mean, I remember a book back in the 70s, you know, nuclear power, the bargain we can't afford. So I'm not sure about that economic profile. Can you help me figure that out?
If you look at the expected cost of electricity from the plants under construction in Georgia and South Carolina, and you look at the price that they want for Cape Wind, you realize the nuclear is probably cheaper.
1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And boy, Matt, I got a stack of emails here I'd like to go through. Here's one from Jane. When nuclear plants were first built, the law provided that homeowner insurance policies would not cover nuclear accidents. Is this still true? Jane says, I'm also very concerned about the problem of nuclear waste, which is still unsolved. And you're right about that, Jane. The nuclear waste problem is unsolved still. What about the homeowner's insurance? Do you know anything about that, Matt? And, of course, I'd love your thoughts on the waste as well.
I'm not sure it's a matter of law, but it is true that your homeowner's policy does not cover nuclear accidents. There is a nuclear insurance plan in place, which is the utilities got together and bought a limited amount of commercial insurance, and they have an agreement enforced by law that if there's an accident, they will all shell out and share the costs. And above that, it becomes a federal responsibility. It has not been, it hasn't yet really been tested, but there is an insurance plan in place, and it's not your homeowner's policy.
Well, and a couple other emails also deal with the issue of waste. Lynn in Sanborn talks about waste. She calls it, don't overlook the mess that is nuclear's waste product. And here's one from Jeff in York, Maine, who says, no matter how safe we make it, it's impossible to get the risk to zero and the consequences of failure are too high. And Jeff says, short-sighted in the sense that even if it were 100% safe, the byproducts are supremely dangerous and essentially eternal. What about that, that you can't get rid of this waste? There's no place to put it, and it never goes away.
Let's go back a step to what's 100% safe. We had, 6 fatalities at a natural gas generating station in Connecticut 3 years ago. We had that pipeline leak that destroyed a neighborhood in San Bruno, California, a couple of years ago. We had the explosion in the Gulf of Mexico at the Macondo well, which was an oil and gas platform. We are certain to have deaths from natural gas. Not huge numbers. We'll have one here, two there, half a dozen here, etc. We are absolutely certain to have deaths from natural gas. We're absolutely certain to have deaths in coal mining. It appears we have a large number of deaths in emissions from burning fossil fuels. You get in with the statistics guys on safety, and it'll make your eyes water. It's just hard to figure it out. But there is no such thing as absolute safety. The wastes, I think the Europeans are going to solve this problem before we do. They're going to find a place to bury the stuff. The volume of waste is relatively small. We've had less problem with nuclear waste in this country than we have, for example, with coal wastes, where the Tennessee Valley Authority had this enormous impoundment of toxic chemicals they'd captured from smokestacks. Then they had a flood, the dam let go, and it wrecked hundreds of acres. Everything we do, every form of electric generation has risk and has consequences. We need electricity for fresh water, for sewage processing, for keeping our food cold, for producing transportation fuels. Electricity is definitely a two-edged sword. It's absolutely essential to the way we live, and every way we get it produces some undesirable result.
Well, Jeff, thank you for the email. Lynn, for your email as well. And back to our callers. And Paul's calling actually from Tacoma Park, Maryland. Hi, Paul. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you, Laura. Well, I just wanted to, first of all, remind listeners that when Matt talks about burying this stuff, nuclear waste, that in fact Hillsborough, Antrim, Stoddard, Henniker, a whole bunch of towns under the Cardigan Pluton there in the Granite State are still on the list at the DOE for burying this stuff. So I think it's a real concern that we can just so lightly brush off taking areas for national sacrifice areas. But, you know, the issue of economics is evolving into very real security problems. Right now, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the industry are talking about basically negating the Atomic Energy Act prohibition on foreign ownership of U.S. nuclear power plants, where right now, you know, they're not allowed to own, control, and dominate. That discussion is moving forward now because U.S. domestic utilities are not investing in this highly astronomically speculative industry.
Well, that's interesting, actually. And Paul, sorry to cut you off. We're heading into a break, though, and I did want to get Matt's thoughts on that. Matt, I had not read about what Paul raises, foreign ownership of nuclear facilities.
That was, I believe, Paul Gunter, who is a professional anti-nuclear activist here. There is a French company that has had wanted to be a partner, wanted to build here. Frankly, I don't think they have the stomach for it economically. And if they did end up coming up and building, and it was astronomically expensive, and they're building in a competitive market, presumably that would be good for consumers. You'd have somebody spending $2 to make a product that's only worth $1, and you'd have to sell it at $1, and we'd buy it at that price. I think when the atomic energy was passed in 1954, we were afraid the damn commies were going to steal our secrets. I don't think we're worried too much about the French doing nefarious things with nuclear power.
All right. Well, Paul, thank you for joining us. And I do have another question for you after a break about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we'll take more of your calls. Stay with us.
This is NHPR. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, new details of the scope of NSA surveillance, then a debut spy novel by a retired CIA agent, all coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Dick Thaxton Realtor, helping customers through the process of selling and buying homes in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Vermont for over two decades, on the web at dickthaxton.com. And the Flying Monkey in Plymouth, presenting an evening of rock and doo-wop with music from the Platters, Drifters, Temptations, and more this Saturday. Tickets at theflyingmonkeynh.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Send email before the program about the headlines that caught your attention this week to exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the problems and prospects for nuclear energy in the U.S. and which way public sentiment seems to be going on this. You can join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Keep those emails short, please. The number, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We're talking this hour with Matthew Wald, longtime reporter for the New York Times. He's covered energy issues for three decades, writes extensively about nuclear energy. And Matt, here's a couple more emails that I'd like to go through with you. Here's one from Anthony, who says, "What about nuclear fusion instead of the current fission process?" First of all, just remind us what the difference is, please, Matt, between fusion and fission, and then to Anthony's question.
In fission, you take a big atom, usually uranium-235, and you split it. It breaks apart, and it releases subatomic particles that split other atoms, and it gives off heat. In fusion, you take two different forms of hydrogen and you squeeze them together, which is, by the way the sun makes energy, and it gives off heat. It's unclear whether you can produce a sustained fusion reaction in a machine on Earth, and it's also unclear if you'd want to. It may again come down to you can't afford it. Fusion and fission both create nuclear waste. The fusion wastes are a little bit smaller, and they don't last quite as long. It's also attractive because we're not going to run out of hydrogen, but whether it's practical is still an open question.
So what about the safety concerns that folks have? Is one necessarily safer than the other?
It's hard to say since we don't actually have the fusion.
Right. We're not doing it right now. But
right. We can produce it for milliseconds and zap some stuff, but we don't really have it up and running. It's hard to say.
So scientists haven't started even speculating about that?
Certainly they've speculated, but I think it's also less likely you'd get a runaway reaction. You're not going to get a runaway reaction in a fusion reactor, but it's whether it's practical in the first place. The safety question may be moot if it's not practical to build it.
Again, getting back to that economics, you know, in terms of other types of ways of using nuclear energy, other innovations that you've written about, Matt, you have said that some in the science community are excited about the prospect of thorium. Again, remind us what this is and why some people think that this could be the next new thing.
Thorium is an abundant element, especially in some parts of the world that need energy, notably India. The United States has early on played around with thorium when we didn't think there was a lot of uranium around. When you do fission with uranium and you throw off the subatomic particles that sustain the reaction, some of those particles are absorbed by thorium, and then the thorium is capable of being split. So you create your fuel and you use your fuel. Alas, it does have some proliferation problems. In other words, it could be used to make materials for a bomb. And it's not really clear that there's a strong reason to do it because we have a lot of uranium around.
So was this something people were more interested in years back, less interested now, or what's going on there, Matt?
It was a very big idea in the early 60s.
Interesting. So same process as nuclear energy, but a different element that you're using.
Similar process and different element, yes.
All right. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, 1-800-892-6477. Here's another email that came in earlier from Sandy, who says, could you have your guest discuss the volume of water needed for these plants? She says, Georgia is in the middle of a drought. Sandy, thanks for the point.
Georgia is in a drought. The Vogtle plant will get its water from the Savannah River, which is a fairly big river. The problem with a nuclear plant and with all steam electric plants, including coal plants, is you use the fuel to heat water to make steam. You use the steam to spin a turbine that makes mechanical power. The turbine spins a generator, which turns the mechanical power into electricity. Generally, that's all they tell you. The next step is you've got all the steam, you've got to turn it back into water so you can send it back to be reheated again. In order to turn the steam back into water, you've got to cool it. You've got to draw water to do that. There's another reactor in New England, Millstone 3, that had in Connecticut, that had an interesting problem last year, which is the water in Long Island Sound got too warm, and it lost. It still had the ability to cool water, but its safety margin was eroded, and it didn't have quite cold enough water to turn all the steam back into water comfortably, so it had to reduce power. You need a lot of water, and you need it to be cold, two things that in a warming world you may have trouble with. The term use water is a little tricky. What they do is they take in water, and they spit it out again warmer. So some of it evaporates, but most of it is dumped back into the body of water it came from, which may or may not be a problem. In some places, you may be killing fish in a river by doing that.
Yeah, if you're increasing the temperature, that may not be good for the local ecosystem there.
It may not. That's correct.
Well, and fracking uses a lot of water, though, too. This gets back to the choices that you presented earlier, that, you know, none of these power sources are perfect.
And when you're done with fracking, what you have is really dirty, contaminated water. When you're done with nuclear, you have water that's been raised a few degrees.
You know, it's interesting. You talked earlier about choices, trade-offs, explosions at, you know, natural gas plants and so forth. What do you think, Matt, as somebody who's been following energy issues for a long time, how are we to reasonably assess risk, trade-off, you know, carbon footprints and so forth? How are we going to sort this all out, and who's going to do that sorting?
Well, I think I'm becoming a capitalist. In my old age, I figured out that what we do depends on what we get paid for. If you gave a bonus to competitors that did not emit carbon dioxide, then the ones that do emit carbon dioxide would run a little less often and we'd build fewer of them. If you don't give such a bonus, either through a cap-and-trade system or a carbon tax, etc., then we'll build whatever is cheapest. The decision will be made in the marketplace. To some extent, the U.S. EPA is now trying to make decisions in a regulatory way. They say future plants will be limited in their carbon dioxide production to X amount per kilowatt hour. Well, they may or may not get that through. They'll probably get some form of that through. But it's not as smooth a way to make a decision as simply to put a price on what you want and a price on what you don't want and let the market figure it out as between offshore wind, onshore wind, solar, hydro, biomass. I've done things in my house that have cut my electric consumption. I also have to say I've done some things that have increased my electric consumption. I like having lights. I have a bunch of new electronic toys that I didn't have 10, 15 years ago. The market is dynamic, and it's hard to tell exactly where it's leading.
Yeah, interesting. All right, let's go back to our listeners, and Tom is waiting in Milford. Hey, Tom, thanks for calling The Exchange. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I know he initially stated he really only put up the options that you're discussing between the gas, the fracking, or the nuclear option. And he mentioned in the construction, of course, the carbon footprint was extreme with what he found with solar panels. Now, that is half truth there from him, because there's new methods of making what, although they're disposable solar panels, they're ones that will not hold up the way the old industrial ones are. China has invented ones that the impact in the building is different. It's a different material, and the impact in the carbon created in their creation, because they've gone well ahead of us in this field. And, of course, what he's talking about is, of course, what can you get the buck for? What is the industry going to be? And this is a generational jump. We have a huge our population is exploding, and he's still thinking from the term, and I guarantee you're both baby boomers, or at least he's a baby boomer, and that's really the most selfish. That's what's gotten us into a lot of this environmental problem in the first place. Very selfish. He's talking about he wants to run all his toys. This generation has had to learn to live with less. As a society, we're going to have to learn to live with less, because as we can see now, there's a smaller percentage of our population that's going to have all the control of those resources. They would like to go gung-ho and charge the rest of us everything. But the wind and the solar, those are renewable, despite the cost in the building.
Well, Tom, a couple topics,
and they
yeah.
can't be charged for.
Tom, a couple topics you brought up, and thank you very much. First of all, to the more practical point, you know, he says, look, the carbon footprint, so to speak, for lack of a better term, of solar has improved, especially given China's interest in innovation in this. What do you think, Matt? And then I have another question for you.
I start out by pleading guilty. Yes, I am a baby boomer. I think, yes. If the Chinese have invented a solar panel that requires less materials to make, that's good for a variety of reasons. One of them is its cost is lower. The caller is correct that you can't charge for sunlight, but you sure can charge for solar panels. And the world will be a better place if he's correct. I don't think, as a general prospect, that people in the United States want to live with less. I think they want... I'm not going to give up my refrigerator. I bought a tablet computer a few weeks ago. I'm having fun with it. I frankly wouldn't think of not buying that because of the electricity it's going to use. And people are free to make their own choices, but as long as we price electricity as cheaply as we do, certainly the price of electricity is not going to stop me from buying a new computer.
I think Tom's picking up on, you know, these changes that we talk about when I asked you a couple minutes ago. How are we going to sort this all out, right? Everybody says we need a new energy future. How are we going to sort it all out? And you talked about some of the market forces that were sorted all out. I think Tom's saying we need to think bigger than that. I mean,
right.
This is the planet.
If we can't price it, we can't do it. If we don't have a price on carbon, then our ability to limit carbon emissions is going to be very small. We could have a change in our political outlook. We could have another two or three Katrinas. We could become convinced that we've messed with the climate in a really bad way, and we could develop a consensus that we need to do something. But at this moment, we don't have that consensus. In addition, if we decided that we really have to do something about climate, some people who call themselves environmentalists might not like the results. For example, we might go on a massive campaign to build more transmission lines across the whole country so we can put up more wind machines. We would kill more birds, that the transmission lines would be ugly, and we would, in fact, cut down carbon emissions pretty sharply. We might go on a campaign to build a lot of reactors. Some people would like that, other people would not.
What you're talking about, you know, a big transmission line project and so forth, this gets into something else that I know you've written about, Matt, and that we've talked a lot about on this program. The idea that maybe we should stop talking about, you know, nuclear here, wind here, solar here, natural gas here, and think of energy more on the micro level. So instead of talking about a big power plant here that transmits all this power to cities, we should talk more about cities producing their own power, people producing it locally, and then maybe you don't have these big controversial projects that get people so upset. What do you think, this macro versus micro idea?
I think New England figured out pretty early. The six New England states, all small with a bunch of small utilities, or at least they were small once upon a time, that there was an advantage in sharing. That, for example, Westport, Maine and Westport, Connecticut, we're not going to have a peak period at the same time. Maine was going to need the stuff in the winter. Connecticut was going to need the stuff in the summer. And if you built a line between them, that's a lot cheaper than building enough power plants in Maine to satisfy Maine and enough power plants in Connecticut to satisfy Connecticut.
So there's an efficiency issue when you have bigger plants.
Efficiency, well, not bigger, if you share them.
Right.
It may be more efficient to build 1,000 megawatts than 100 megawatts, but it's also true that if you and I are connected, if I have a mechanical problem or you have a need when I don't have one, we're better off sharing resources than each providing for himself. Self-sufficiency is nice, but in electric terms, it's expensive and may not be desirable. There may be reasons to produce electricity locally, but there are also reasons to have a grid to share.
Well, thanks a lot for that call, Tom. And let's see if we can take one more. This is Lou in Richmond. Hi, Lou. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm in my car. I'm just going to stop so I don't lose you again. I just wanted to point out that right now the global population is 7 billion, and it's projected to be 10 billion by the end of this century. And I think instead of just talking about New Hampshire and New England, we need to be thinking globally. We just can't keep generating the greenhouse gases. And the way I look at it, the nuclear is about the only option we have to provide enough energy for all the people that are going to be, as Matt says, you know, they're going to want their toys too.
Well, Lou, thanks a lot, and I'm going to let you go because we're coming close to the end of the hour. But this is the reason, right, Matt, that the nuclear industry, until Fukushima, expected a renaissance. People like Lou who said, look, I'm more worried about carbon and climate change than I am about nuclear power.
Yes, but the industry, parts of it still expect a renaissance, and they're doing things like designing reactors explicitly for the third world. They're smaller. You build them in a factory here, and you ship them abroad. They can meet local need. They don't have to go in a country that has a big grid. One of the troubles with nuclear power is a reactor is a big machine. If you put it on a small grid and the reactor goes offline, something goes wrong, it shuts itself down, you could end up with a blackout. The reactors we have now only work on big systems. People are hoping, the U.S. government is hoping, that we develop an export product, a modular reactor, that you put on a ship, you haul by truck, and you install somewhere. in Manila, in Bangkok, in places where there's growing electric demand, where they need something clean because the air is already filthy.
These are these, what are they called, small modular reactors, SMRs, is
right.
what they call them?
Right.
Right. And it's interesting, it reminds me of a conversation we had about a year ago with someone from India who talked about reverse innovation, new products being designed for these less developed countries that might actually spark changes here in this country. So real interesting. And Matt, thank you very much for joining us this hour. Really appreciate it.
Laura,
hope to talk
you.
To you again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Matthew Wald again, longtime reporter for the New York Times. He's been covering energy issues for 30 years, writes a lot lately about nuclear energy. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Catherine Muzzy. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm, Alan Cohen, and John Barrett. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The state Senate prepares to elect a new president after Peter Bragdon said he'd step aside amid controversy over a possible conflict of interest. The first mosquitoes with Triple E are confirmed in the Granite State, and the Queen City prepares for 200 new refugees 1 year after a proposed moratorium on resettlements. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show is next at 10 o'clock here on NHPR, where we get support from UR members. And support also comes to us from the Shaheen and Gordon Law Firm, business and corporate law, health care, family matters, criminal defense, and personal injury. Offices in Dover, Concord, and Manchester. ShaheenGordon.com. And from Comcast Business, lending support and applauding the work of organizations such as the ABI Innovation Hub. Additional information at abihub.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1, WEVS Nashua 88.3, WEVH Hanover 91.3, WEVN Keene 90.7,
WEVC Gorham 107.1,
WEVJ Jackson 99.5,
WEVF Colebrook 90.3,
and WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning. It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Steve Roberts of George Washington University, sitting in for Diane Rehm. According to documents declassified yesterday in 2011, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court ruled a data collection method being used by the NSA was unconstitutional. It was a process that failed to specifically exclude thousands of emails and other electronic communications